I'm sure all of you know the story, where the next spring a search and rescue team went out and they found all of the frozen bodies. They had all died. But they had all kept diaries. And when the diaries were collated and brought together, it was an incredible story of human courage. They never, any one of them, ever gave up. But the circumstances were impossible. And it didn't matter that they had, they gave all that they could give. They were just simply, it was a case where they were outdistanced and outclassed by the opposition. That does happen. Not so frequently, but it does happen. But one sets oneself to continue indefinitely, not setting any limits whatsoever. So that one of the qualities here in dealing with magic energy, in ancient times, in every civilization, and I had examples from China, from ancient Greece, and from ancient Sumer that I was going to bring forward, and I may not have time to do it. In every case, the top wielder of magic in ancient civilizations was the king. The performer of the magic, the big magician, was the king. In whatever form, the pharaoh, the emperor, the king. It was his responsibility above all else to perform the magic that allows for human life to continue. The king is the one who can do this, who in fact does do this. That is the king. Now in the classical sense that has come down to us, the mythological prototype is always that the magician is a counselor to the king, like Merlin to King Arthur. That's the mythological form. But the mythological form does not reflect the actual activity. It reflects a kind of an archetypal projected meaning. In this sense, Merlin is the guardian spirit of Arthur. He's the tutorial spirit of Arthur. He is a higher function of Arthur. So in the mythological play of it, the way that the symbolic mythic image is remembered is that the magician is a counselor to the king. But in actual fact, in ancient times, the king was the magician. And the divine right of kings all centered around the issue of the fact that the magic was his prerogative. Now things have changed in the last couple of thousand years, and the understanding now, quite accurately, is that everyone's interior self is your king. Your deep self is your king. And the big magic is not the prerogative of the ego, no matter how clever and intelligent the goddamn thing is. It's not the prerogative of the ego to wield the magic, but the deep self. That's the real king. And the ego, no matter how glorious it is a usurper in that sense. Doesn't have to be, but very, very frequently it comes down to that. Tim Leary, not the dodgy pitcher, but the old psychedelic priest, one time in a conversation, I used to have a bookstore in one previous life on Hollywood Boulevard, and I had a wild jungle in the back that we used to have wild sessions of conversations squatting in the weeds like ancient times. Tim Leary one time said he's convinced the ego is the ultimate intelligence agent. It's got the best infiltration staff in the cosmos and got it all under wrap and key. And breaking free is almost like trying to get out of a perfect totalitarian state. Because every function that you think you can count on is an informer. But the one function that doesn't turn informer, can't rat, is the sense of the wholeness of yourself. The ego has covered everything, every part, but not the whole, because the ego doesn't see the whole, thinks it's the whole. And in that mistake leaves wide open a secret exit and entrance to the internal revolution that has to happen. Because as long as you deal with your wholeness as much as possible, you sidestep, you end run the ego and all of its infiltration, informant system. You outdistance the secret place of your cunning self. So that in dealing with wholeness as much as possible all the time, is like one of the secrets of self-development. And by sticking to that as much as possible, one makes one's way, quietly, silently, back to the center that is really there, back out to the person who is really possible. And how does Shelley say it? At the end of the Prometheus Unbound, he says, this alone is life, joy, empire, and victory. Well, we better take a break. Let's take a break. We'll get to your projects in just one moment. I don't want to usurp any more time than is necessary. But this morning, we participated in basic divination. There was a structure to what we did. First of all, one must sensitize. In some times, some periods of history, in some cultures, the only highly sensitized object in the house would be your Bible or your Quran or your Torah, so that the sacred book would have been used for a kind of bibliomancy. It isn't that bibliomancy is a different form of divination than from others, but it's a variant on the basic theme. It's just to use something that is really sensitized. And in those periods of history, in those places where people lived very disadvantaged lives, sometimes the only sacred object in their lives was the Torah or the Quran or the Bible that they were able to carry. It was the only sacred object in this universe that was left to them. The basis of divination is that one wishes to contact higher powers, so that one uses some object in this world as a prism, as a prism to focus one's questions, one's aspirations, one's desperate moments, that they are focused by this prism, in that by the same token, coming the other way on that two-way street, what the divine power or the divine energy could communicate to you is brought to a focus and condensed in that prism. And thus that object, that sacred object, that divinatory object is the go-between. It's where the record is made. its guarantee is that it is a basic part of life. It is a sacred structure in life. Now, coins have been used for divination in our time very frequently, but money is not an object, but an energy, and it's not a very good divination form to talk in form. You can. I use rice now. I use rice because rice is a basic life form, and divination by rice grains is traditional in Asia. In archaic times, yarrow stalks were used, it's true, but in more civilized times, rice is very, very adequate. So in our divination, notice that I put the rice into a sacred bowl, this silver bowl that came to me in a very odd set of circumstances. I bought a house up by the observatory a number of years ago, and I was having enlargements made. Because it was high in the hills, I had to have a lot of excavation. And one of the workmen in the excavation came over to me, and it had this cup all filled with clay, and there's a clay-covered hand, and his hat was in his hand. And I realized, seeing him, that it's a very unusual moment. He was touched. He was full of of respect, not so much for me. I don't pronounce that kind of respect, but for the occurrence. And he said, I have found this on your land, and it belongs to you. And when he gave it to me, he took his clay smudged finger and brushed some clay aside, and he said, "See, it has a tree." And I looked, and it has engraved on it the tree of life. It's a very peculiar thing. The roots are separate from the branches. There's this gap, there's a space. There's like a synapse gap in between the roots and the branches, the trunk. Just like it should be. But the way in which it came to me, which was in the mid-70s, made it a very special object. It came in just the right way. It came with the humility of a human being who, in a guileless way, presented the thing conscious of the energy. And I've kept it undesecrated from that time. It had been buried who knows how long. It was found in about 3 feet of earth in behind a garage, and that house had been built by an architect in 1922. So I used that bowl. It's been used in just a couple of times. The last time we did the hermetic wisdom liturgy here, yeah, that was the cup. So I put the rice in there, and on top of it, I put a bell, which is a Tibetan Vajra bell, a form of Vajra bell, which I received also about the time of the cup, but in different circumstances. I received it from Karma Pingla Rinpoche. I sponsored him to come to L.A. in 1975-76 to deliver lectures on the Kagyupa tradition, the Karmapa lineage, and on the Tibetan language, the Sinic Songliness. I thought there needs to be a little bit of drop of tincture of honesty in all subjects. So I got that from him at that time. His portrait is in the blue in the back there. That's his portrait, his signature in green underneath it. But in talking with him, I took the dinger out of the bell. I took the little stone too, so that the bell rings silently, as it were. There is a little bit of a sound if you pick it up. That sound, incidentally, is a small form of the sound that would have been made by an ancient Egyptian mystery instrument that was held by the high priestess. Sometimes, anyway, it's the same sound. It's interesting. So this Vajra bell of no note and this silver, sterling silver cup from the earth, those gifts were the vehicles that held that rice, held an everyday important object which is truly deserving of being a prison. In the way that rice is written, the character for rice in Japanese, it has a radical that includes 88, the number 88. And the Zen explication of certain symbols always points out that rice is an object that comes to you after having gone through 88 hands to come to you. Somebody didn't just pick it and you have it, but it's gone through a whole sequence of human activity. And without that sequence being intact, you don't eat. So its basic message is that life is a cooperation, and that other people are important, even though you may not believe it. They are important in an essential, necessary way to your existence. And rice as a symbol is a way of just graphically, every time you sit down to get nourishment from it, to realize that that's true, that other people are important in that fundamental way. They're necessary to your life, and therefore they're worthy of your respect and your care, just like your own life energy would do. Now the ego really never understands this. The self really never forgets this. In that basic struggle that we talked about this morning between the self and the ego, in that basic struggle, the openness that you keep has its integrity and strength, not just from the openness of your possibility, but the fact that your openness in every possibility is interrelated with other people, so that your openness in terms of a spiritual community is always the way in which a self manages to win the conflict with the ego, and that the vector of your real person develops in that sense, so that when someone comes through that struggle, one of the hallmarks of that struggle being successful, one of the hallmarks of a human being emerging in their own life, is that they really do care for other human beings. Not as a doctrine, but as a basic bone relationship to life. You know that other people are indigenously important in a necessary way to your life. As if caring for other people, the religious word for it is compassion, is not an ideal, and it's not a doctrine, but it is an ethical conviction which you know exactly because you got there in a very exact way. So it's a value in those terms. So we use rice as a prison, as a divinatory prison this morning, in juncture with these two sacred objects brought together. So the rice is a divinatory interface between the silent Vajra bell, Vajra means sun, and the sterling silver cup with the tree of life in gold. So in between the brass and the silver, in between the silence and the opening, was our divinatory meeting. And I pass that ensemble around to each of you, voiceless, and everyone touched that in their own way, without any direction. So there's towards the end a little bit of direction given, but it was characteristic and inadvertent, so it didn't amount to any direction. You all in your own way handled it in a native way. There was no design. So that the openness of that linking was imprinted on this medium. Because of the way in which I prepared this medium, it was ready to receive that energy pattern, which may not be very distinct in terms of machines that could measure it, although I must tell you that we could build machines that could measure that. But this medium, like real fine photographic background, what do you call that? The thing of photographs, the record. The gel, the silver nitrate gel. Yeah. This medium, the rice, recorded this community. Recorded what? We didn't ask any question. We didn't ask any pointedness. So it recorded what the basic cross-section quality of what is happening here. So we did a divination specifically of what is this group. And so I've turned the rice into a numerical sequence, and then from that into a lined sequence, and we did an I Ching divination as well. So I had to tell you all that so you could appreciate how finely ground this is, and it isn't like just bibliomancy. The hexagram that you came up with turns out to be number 35, which is progress. Change. Progress. And the image of it is fire above the earth. Fire above the earth. But in order to get the full meaning of the hexagram, I translated it to the five-phase Dawa cycle, and you can consult it later on for yourself. The beginning, the zero-base Dao of this particular divination was hexagram number 5, which is nourishment, or sometimes it's called waiting, but it's basically nourishment. And its commentary, the Confucian commentary, the Ta Chung, begins, all beings have need of nourishment from above, but the gift of food comes in its own time, and for this one must wait. So the true divination begins with that sentence and goes through 5 hexagrams, and the 5th hexagram is number 50. And I'll just give you that, and then you can piece together for yourself. I'll leave the numbers out, and you can get the full reading. So it begins with nourishment, and the last hexagram in that whole energy sequence was number 50. Well, already you can see numerically it begins with 5 and ends with 50. And if you're Pythagorean at all, well, number 50 turns out to be 10, the cauldron. So what is the cauldron? The cauldron is the basic metal vehicle where the family cooks the rice. So if some of you are wondering if there's any efficacy to what you're doing, why, I Ching says, apparently there is. Now to our project. I won't get to this history of magic. I'll try and bring some of it in next week for you, just to sensitize your acquaintance with a little bit of Chinese and Egyptian and Celtic and Greek magic tradition. So you can see that, indeed, everywhere in the world, the process of psychic energy works the same way. Not only that, but the deep self experience is the same. The person making function is the same. Someone who becomes a person in China doesn't do it by some other way as someone who becomes a person 5,000 years ago along the Nile. There's no difference. It's what makes human nature universal. It's what makes ability to communicate with each other over vast periods of time, vast differences of culture, it makes it efficacious. Many people today talk about a planetary culture, but they're very egotistical. They think that planetary means the people who are alive today. Planetary means everyone who has ever lived on this planet in one family. That's the ecumenicos that Alexander the Great was meant, and could we settle for anything less? So a planetary culture means everyone. And before we can go to some other star system, some other planetary system, as we are free to do, if and when we are together as a single soul. Pursuant to this, we've been reading Jung's Alchemical Studies, one of our magic texts, because Uncle Carl is one of the two great magicians of the 20th century. As much respect as I have for Mr. Hall, Jung is a better magician. And equal to Jung was W.B. Yeats. And Yeats and Jung are the two great magicians of the 20th century. They are really incredible. If you don't know much about Yeats, you might investigate. And Yeats was a teenager first getting into occult things in London. He would go and visit Madame Blavatsky, and she would tell her occult people to leave him alone, that he was busy looking around. When she first saw him, he stood in her parlor and was staring at her cuckoo clock, which didn't have any working parts, but the bird had come out anyway, and Yeats was staring at it. And he had inspected it like a young Irishman would do, and he had seen it didn't have any working parts, so he was looking at it with his penetrating spiritual energy to see how dost thou come out, wooden bird. And Madam was watching him all the time from the other room, so rolling his cigarette, and she saw this, and then she always made room for Willie to be himself. He became his spirit mother. So Yeats is really somebody. But we have Jung. And of Jung, his Alchemical Studies, that book in the collective works, is one of the most powerful of all of the works in order to understand magic. And it's interesting, synchronistically, that there are five parts, five sections. And the very first one, the zero base of the five, is the Taoist one, the secret of the golden flower. And the other four follow almost synchronistically in the same kind of unfolding pattern that one would find. It's the same five-fold pattern that you find in the Upanishads, in ancient Vedic times, that you find in Taoism, in ancient Far East civilizations, the same five that you find in the Celtic star magic from ancient Egyptian Hermetic mystery. Ireland and Egypt are related together. So all of the basic core patterns are there, and it's as if all the integrity that went into making the Bollingen series and the collected works of Jung was so intensely honest that the right forms came out in the right places. Do you know what volume in the collected works Alchemical Studies is? Have you looked at all? It doesn't show on your paperback, but if you pull out Alchemical Studies from the collected work, it's volume 13. 13. What I'm trying to make conscious for you here is that if we work with great integrity, almost in spite of the obstacles, the truth comes out. Almost in spite of everything that can be done to scramble it up and not let it work, lack of participation, distortion, or even with all of that, the true form still comes out. And that's what we need to sensitize ourselves to in this second year, to be conscious that The truth is there, even though we can't see it yet, it is there. And so, to remind our consciousness, keep looking, Jack, it's there. Because we have done this right. It's just like the hexagram sequence that came out here, that five hexagram sequence, beginning with nourishment and ending with the cooking pot. And that we're progress somewhere in between. We are there. That is exactly where we are in terms of the communicative, symbolic imagery of the I Ching. It's a very accurate way for the I Ching to express to us where we are and what we're doing. We're making progress towards getting a vehicle so that we can cook that life and live. But right now our problem is making a transition from magic to art. And as I pointed out to you this morning, it's a very difficult problem because it involves a transformation that essentially is a conflict. The conflict is between the self and the ego. But the person that's going to come out is neither. The person that's going to come out is a vector from the self, which is original, never has been seen before. Your real person is original, has never been seen before. And so it's important, let's see if I can use, there was a French philosopher died a few years ago, Maurice Merleau-Ponty. And in his book on Humanism and Terror, he says that we have to learn to give up the Kantian imperative, which asks that before we do anything, we ask, well, what if everyone did this? And on that basis, a lot doesn't get done. That we have to put in place of that Kantian categorical imperative an existential imperative, which asks the question, not what if everyone did it, but what if no one did this? And very frequently the answer to that conscious query is that the universe would be minus this value. Therefore, I will do this. I have these capacities, I have this interest, and just because no one else has done this, well then I will do it. It's the courage of being a minority of one, as the old belief says. You have to have that courage in this world, because this world specializes at this particular time in grinding everyone up in those categorical imperative limitations. And you have to have the courage to realize, well, I'm going to do it this way. And you don't have to be pushy in this sense. You can do it in any fashion, any style that you want. You can do it hemming and hawing and still do it. And it's so effective. So that transformation between the psychic energy of magic and the emergent form of the personal with its own ethical value is necessary. That person has to be born. It's like a birth. And it's a travail, like a birth would be. But in order to understand that travail, we have to be conscious of it, and for that we have to learn from a magician. In particular, a magician who was good enough a magician to be an artist. Now, Yeats was an artist as a playwright and as a poet. What was Jung an artist at? Jung was an artist at person-making. Look, every description of Jung by his contemporaries, by people that knew him, they all said he was an incredible character. That's what Fortier was saying, he was his own person. Charismatic, one of a kind. He was an artist at person-making. That's what he did all the time. He worked with maybe 25, 35,000 people in his lifetime and helped a good portion of those become their own person, using artist and person making. He understood that the big magic is to get a person shape viable with the life energy. That's the big magic. Making some cup jump off the table is hardly even worth talking about. Making a newspaper burst into fire with your hand and your own body heat. These are throwaway politics. The big magic is getting a human person, original person, born with all the capacities of consciousness and life energy viable. That is big magic. And every time it happens, what's the saying in the Mahayana? Everybody in the cosmos comes to see this first. Every time someone gets free and is themselves, every freed entity in the universe is interested in that. I should use the term sentient being. Entity is a little charged in that. The gods are always happy that some human being is able to get free. So we need to understand magic. And we're using volume 13 of Jung, Alchemical Studies, pursuant to that. And that there's a pattern, there's a sequence to this volume. Now, if I presented the ideas exclusively here and gave you Alchemical Studies in that kind of a professorial way, it would do you no good. You can't use that in your nourishment for your struggle, for your rebirth. What you can use right now at this particular moment is a reminder about the communal aspect, the community aspect of the way in which meaning through psychic energy becomes a viable personal valuation. And for that, our assignments have been for various subgroups of this community to take the various chapters, the five sections, and in your own way, without any advice from me or any guidance from me other than the fact, look, you people are together, find some way to do this. Any way that you do, it's just fine. Unfortunately, one of the lacks is that you don't have very much contact outside of Saturday morning with each other. You can see that there would be a whole different dimension to this aspect of throw if it were other than that. We have to work with that limitation. Also, the fact that I'm trying to teach a pioneering way that isn't familiar at all anymore. No one has seen this for 300 years. No one has seen this pattern since the heyday of the last flourish of the Renaissance in Amsterdam in the 1660s. Time of Rembrandt and Comenius and Spinoza. The last time anybody ever was able to be public about this. So it's been a long time, and everyone in the meantime has gotten used to third-rate ways from fourth-rate people. So what's important here is that I don't dominate, but I've had to dominate the discussion very forcefully in order to deliver to you the perspectives that you need to understand what's going on, so that it's more important for you to understand what's going on than to actually accomplish this assignment at this particular time. Look, I'm going to be here a long time, and there's going to be lots of opportunities to do it again and learn whatever you need to learn. There's no problem with that at all. So don't be too worried if it seems that on one hand I'm overdoing my part, or on the other hand I'm allowing you to overdo things in your part. The balance will work out in its own way. The ting will be full of our rights when it comes time that we have to speak. On The Secret of the Golden Flower last week, I gave you a sequence of paragraphs, and If you weren't here, you can get them from this sheet. This is the core of the intellectual argument of Hume in his commentary on The Secret of the Golden Flower. If you need a structure for an intellectual argument, that's it right there. And you can reread it with that structure and get his ideational meaning. But we have four more to do, and I'm hoping to get through at least one today, and hopefully next week we can do the last three together. We'll do Ibn Arabi, Journey to the Lord of Power, do a little bit about magic, and we'll do the last three. The second one that we have to get to today, though, is the vision of Zosimus, and for this we had Carol and Jerry and Donna. So, look what I'm doing. I'm saying, Carol and Jerry and Donna, whatever you do is all right. Whatever you decided to do is exactly right. So here's the time space, and our confidence is with you, and our trust is in your hands. So take over from here. And when you're finished, the class will be finished. No more words from me. When you're finished, we're finished. All right?